The Agora podcast is covered by a BIPCOT no-gov license. Use and reuse is free and encouraged by anyone except governments or their agents. Find out more at BIPCOT.org.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop.
You were born free, you got fucked out of half of it, and you wave a flag celebrating.
Central authority has just embedded right in it its own problem, and that is that it means a few people make decisions for many people.
All right, folks, welcome back to Agora Podcast. It's me, Penguin, here with my co-host, Zach Magora. Zach, how you been? We're back. It's been a little while for the most part. I think we had one episode this year, but it's good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. We'll be doing more of these here in the coming weeks and stuff. But yeah, I've been dealing with some health issues in the winter and the holidays and stuff. So yeah, I've been just kind of getting ready for spring, and I've been behind on everything. So, but yeah, good to be back.
It's my holiday season for sure. Yeah. It's that time of the year.
Yeah. Happy Ramadan.
Up early, up late, fasting, doing the whole thing. And it's kind of rough with the, you know, the nature greening up again and getting back to business, but that's just how it is this time of year.
Yeah, for sure. I bet you feel better after it's all done, though. All that fasting.
Oh, for sure. Sure. And it's good. It's honestly, it's good for everyone to experience hunger. And it's over time. I mean, it's a bad thing to experience like chronic hunger and like a famine, but like, you know, people can stay fed, but like it's more and more uncommon for people to ever really feel that kind of hunger where it's like involuntary. And it's not really technically involuntary, but it's, you know, it's not a hunger that you're putting yourself through for some reason, or are you can grab food at any time, which we live in, let's face it, a society where you can grab food. And it's good to be able to feel not being able to satisfy that. I think it really builds you up. And I think it's, something that everyone should experience, whether religious or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, just doing like intermittent fasting is supposed to be super good for you. So,
that's what they say. Right.
It does make you appreciate food more. Well, speaking of going hungry, we got, Keith McHenry, the one and only, on the show today. Keith, how are you, man?
Oh, doing really well. Well as you could do in the turbulent times that we're in. So, but yeah, the Food Not Bombs here is doing really great, and that's very inspiring. Being at the meal, it's incredible.
Awesome. Well, let's, Keith, you've been on the show a couple of times, and I'm sure everybody listening is familiar. But just in case somebody isn't, again, who are you, and what do you do? If you could give a brief introduction, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I'm the one of the eight people that started Food Not Bombs in Boston in 1980, and I've been doing Food Not Bombs ever since. So other people have kind of come and gone over the years of that original eight, and I also am the author of three books on one is Food Not Bombs: How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, and that eventually went out of print. So then I did, I wrote Hungry for Peace, which is a much larger, expansive book on Food Not Bombs with vegan recipes for 100 and so on, and also vegan recipes for 6. And then, but it tells you basically how to organize a Food Not Bombs and how to organize meetings and the history of Food Not Bombs, that kind of thing. And then the third book that has been published is The Anarchist Cookbook, which I wrote with my C-Sharp Press publisher, Chaz Buffet. And so the bulk of it was actually my writing. And William Powell, who wrote the original sort of, I wouldn't even call it wrote, but put together the first Anarchist Cookbook, which most people know of, which it turns out was not that really a part of an anarchist movement at all. In fact, when I wrote him before his death to tell him I was going to rewrite the book and I wanted to use his denunciation of his book, he got back to me and said, yeah, that's fine. And he was a principal at a private school in Kuala Lumpur at the time, and at a private religious school, which is unusual for anarchists to do that. And I don't think he really had any history of being an anarchist. He just did the book, according to him, to stay out of the draft in Vietnam. And he put together stuff about bomb making and stuff. And that's how, you know, how people associate the Anarchist Cookbook. It had no anarchism in it. So that's why Chaz and I thought, well, we should just redo the book so that people look up anarchism. They don't get his phony book. They get a book on anarchism. So that's the last one that's been published of my books. And my memoir is Soup Street. I have a literary agent that is trying to get it, sell it to a publisher at this point, because my poor, you know, publisher is doesn't have the resources really to kick it out there. But the worst case, I'll ask Chaz if he wants to publish it and see what he says. But I'm pretty sure I'll get like a larger, a publisher with some resources, a publisher with social media, which is somewhat helpful. But I do love Chaz, so not to speak ill of him, because he and I have worked together for decades, and he's a great anarchist publisher. I've been doing Food Not Bombs for this whole time, and San Francisco, I did 500 days in jail for feeding the hungry there. There were 45 counts of felony conspiracy to serve free food with the hungry, without a permit, the permit that was deleted. And I faced 25 to life in prison in 94. And I settled that case in 95 by pleading out on one of the felonies in exchange for credit for time served, which is where the number 500 comes from. And let's see, I've traveled all over the world speaking about Food Not Bombs. And I've been kind of semi-homeless most of the time. I did do a permaculture school and natural building school for many years in Taos, New Mexico, on a piece of farmland that I owned. I lived in a bus and a van during those years. And now I live in Santa Cruz, California, where I do Food Not Bombs, basically some aspect of Food Not Bombs all day, every day. But our meals have been cut back to weekends from being 7 days a week for 3 years during the COVID lockdown. So that kept me super busy with that. And I write essays. You can go see my blog, anarchistcook.blog, and see what I'm saying about these issues. And that's what I've been basically doing.
And you can find all your books at foodnotbombs.net, right?
Correct. Yeah. You can even get them. The ones that are published, the two, Hungry for Peace and Anarchist Cookbook, you can get even read the whole books or download the whole books off PDFs. But you can also buy them from us if you want.
Great, great. And according to the FBI, you're a terrorist. Is that right?
Yeah. So on August 29th, 1988, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force happened to observe or sent a memo to the FBI office in San Francisco claiming we were a credible national security threat. And that was after they observed the second week of arrests at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. So 9 of us were arrested on August 15th, 1988. I was the first one arrested, even though technically that day I didn't serve any food. I'd actually just walked from the hospital over there after having a ruptured appendix 7 days before. But I was the so-called ringleader, probably. That's probably what. And also, I was the one that stupidly wrote a letter to the Parks Department requesting a street performance permit to do the meals at the entrance to Golden Gate Park every Monday. And it turned out that was a scam. It was a purpose of trying to find out. Because at that time, as is generally the case, even though it's technically my real name is Keith McHenry, there's more to it than that. And I, in those days, I was underground at the time, and everything was kind of, so I'm sure that's part of the, and they didn't have cell phones in those days and so on like that. So they're trying to figure out who I was, basically, even though they were following me around, I'm sure by that time. And because I had all my utilities alias, for example, and I rented an apartment and an alias, and I had abandoned basically my past for personal safety reasons for the mob, try not to be killed by them. But anyway, so because of feeding the hungry and also not putting up with their bullshit in Boston, so I hope you're allowed to say that on the program. So that was like 9 of us on the August 15th, and then on the next Monday, 22nd, I believe it is, that there were 24 people arrested, and that freaked out the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, which must have potentially been monitoring me anyway all the way, because there is a connection possibly between Whitey Bulger and my need to flee Boston. He was in the Winterhell gang, but he was a double agent with the FBI, and somebody was sent to kill me, and I knew, I got some warning of that, and hence went underground. But and there was that was the early days of attempting to criminalize the homeless and all that, 1985, 86, around then. The Broken Windows study, which was the original, pseudoscience theory of why you had to get rid of homeless people, had just been published in The Atlantic and so on. And so they were stepping up under the Clinton administration. It got really bad to get rid of homeless people. And so I was putting up a fight against that. And some of the interests were with organized crime, which is normal. That's particularly normal with CIA, FBI, mob. They're all kind of all work together. So that's why they were probably asking me to, there kept being this hippie coming by. Oh yeah, you can get a permit. Just write a letter to the Parks Department. So that's when we didn't. So on the 22nd, when we refused to cooperate because they wanted us to serve food in an armory out by the ocean, because they were saying that, making a political statement was not allowed. And we refused. And I think that was part of the reason the FBI called us a credible national security threat, is we were not willing to just, when the cops tell you do something, then we go do it. No, we had a philosophy that we'd already had for 8 years, and we weren't about to back down on that. And the other thing was, maybe 11 years later, the State Department held in 2009 a lecture at Tufts University, a school of diplomacy, and Fletcher School of Diplomacy in Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, a lecture comparing us to Al-Qaeda, who was more dangerous, Funa bombs or Al-Qaeda. And then the wrapping up of the lecture, they said that Funa bombs was much more dangerous because we were local people in our communities that were calling for money to be diverted from military spending to education, healthcare, and other social services, and that we were friendly and popular, and Al-Qaeda was like a dying movement, and probably because they knew they were paying for it, and it would not last another 20 years, but Funap bombs would probably last longer than another 30 years. And so, but what's interesting, if you go back to that August 29th FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force memo calling us a credible national security threat, there were 9 or 10 of us in San Francisco that were doing Funap bombs since March of that year. So this is August 29th when they send the memo. There were about 8 or 9 people in Boston Funap bombs who coincidentally, a few of them went down to D.C. at that were going to go to D.C. to serve food at a protest against the war in El Salvador. And there were 9 or 10 Funap bombs activists in Long Beach, California. So roughly there were 30 Funap bombs people in the entire world. And the FBI was already declaring us a credible national security threat. There also some background, too, in San Francisco, which I have yet to, you know, I can't find it because of the way Google now is like deleting everything and stuff. And even the Wayback Machine deletes a lot of stuff now. Apparently Bechtel Corporation, which was headquartered in San Francisco. And at that time, I think George Shultz was the head of it. And then Chevron Corporation's headquarters was also in San Francisco at that time, and Bank of America headquarters was there. And they were said to, in some local media reports, claim that they were particularly concerned about Funap bombs, and they had gone to the FBI and the local San Francisco police to try to suppress us for fear that, you know, we were putting that idea that money should be spent on stuff that people needed rather than on war. And that since those were 3 major military contractors, that they were putting pressure on the local city. There's also a Hong Kong real estate company that also seemed to be involved because they were trying to gentrify the Haight-Ashbury. In fact, they renamed it Coal Valley to try to fool people into thinking they were not buying property in the Haight. The Haight was, you know, still, yet to be gentrified at that time. And so there was a confluence of interest. And then the other that had nothing to do with national security stuff, but the local police department wanted to make sure the newly installed mayor knew his place and wanted to embarrass him. So there was there's like an alliance of these factions that were interested in suppressing Funap bombs. But the weird thing was that they accidentally made Funap bombs blossom, and that was the and that's why we're now in way over 1,000 cities of the world and over 65 countries, because each wave of arrests, or like my 3 strikes case, each of these things that you know, spread ideas around the world. Punk bands who then became interested in this because they did, you know, benefit concerts for us and then put us in the liner notes, like Propagandhi or Fugazi or MDC and all them, you know, Good Riddance. So that spread it around the world. So they actually created their own mistake. And I think that's kind of funny, too, because if you look back to the founding of Funap bombs in the summer of founding, we, like 4 of us were working at a Boy Scout camp that was being rented out to the state mental hospital for the most profoundly out of it mental people. And so we had then access to this Boy Scout camp on the weekends for us. And we had a hookup that turned out was probably CIA LSD, but we would do that and dress in hobbit clothing and stuff and discuss our philosophy that became Food Not Bombs, tripping on what appears to have been CIA presented LSD. And we know that because the guy that, there's a couple of reasons we're suspicious it was made by the CIA. One was it was Mickey Fantasia acid, blotter acid, and I'm a graphic designer. And at that time, you needed a Heidelberg 6-color press to print the images on the blotter acid, and not everybody has those. And the registration of a full color image of Mickey from Fantasia with a wand that small would be impossible to do with such perfect sheet after sheet after sheet of 100 hits, because it was like 100 of these images on every sheet. And the acid was completely pure with no, and really good quality with no strychnine. And then eventually there became news stories about how the reason it was printed so well was that they didn't want counterfeit, and they were trying to track the patterns of LSD through New England at the time. So they've inadvertently helped Food Not Bombs really create its
philosophy. So basically the CIA started Food Not Bombs.
Yeah, in this weird kind of way. Well, in another way, they kind of did too, because if you go back to my youth, so my grandfather, I have two interesting grandfathers, the yin and the yang of grandfathers. So my dad's father was a national park ranger. He lived with the Hopi in the 30s, way before electricity ever came to the Hopi land. And then therefore he took me to visit his friends, the elders there when I was in the first and second grades. And I got to see the snake dance, and it transformed my life, you know, spending time on the Hopi land on first, second, and third Mesa. He lived at Old Araibi. He was the only non-Hopi to spend time in that kiva there. And he's the only person to take photos in a kiva that was still being used for sacred purposes. And when he was in World War One, and he was a medic in the trenches in Belgium. So he has perspective on war and nature, and so was very different than my mother's father, who went to Phillips Exeter, where George Bush Sr. went, and then went to Dartmouth College, and then went to Harvard Law at the time that Henry Kissinger was starting to lurk around there, and so on. So he was recruited into a satanic cult of some nature, which he never told me the name of, he might have been recruited even at Phillips Exeter, but it might have been Harvard or Dartmouth. And he is most well known for being the director of the most deadly bombing campaign in world history, called Operation Meeting House, and where he firebombed Tokyo. And he so I got to meet a lot of the pilots and gunmen at the B-29 bomber conventions growing up. But also he was grooming me to, you know, become part of this surveillance CIA operations in the future. And because he was in OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and his friends started this organization called the Central Intelligence Agency. And one of his best friends was Curtis LeMay, a general who oversaw the Pacific War at that time. And that's how he became one of the reasons he was very tight. And he explained why the U.S. government did, for instance, Pearl Harbor. You know, he was very clear about how they organized it, told me the details. Even as early as 6 years old, I was learning about that. And he was also explaining how the elections were designed for to divide the country, wherever the elections were or whatever the population was. City elections, county elections, state elections, national elections were never allowed to determine the direction of a society. That was left up to people like ourselves, who were genetically superior, you know, because we were somehow genetically superior, according to him, and that we were to determine who not only who ran, you know, who was put into power as the token puppet figureheads, but also that we were to determine who lived and who died. And I would have that responsibility. And he called that white man's privilege, you know, that when I grew up, I might have to kill tens of thousands of millions of people. And the people I have to kill would not, they have no moral qualms about being killed. So it's up to us to be strong. And when we have to kill people for corporate power. And then he had 63 black and white photos he took of the firebombing of Tokyo. He would fly by in another B-29 bomber afterwards at about 20,000 feet, maybe 30,000 feet. So here, one grandfather in a trench underground in a chemical warfare with dying people. Other 20,000 feet above, tens of thousands of burning people taking pictures. And anyway, he was teaching me that. And then he had those photos in his den. And what was particularly striking in Needham, Massachusetts, and he was like a corporate lawyer that was probably connected to, for example, sold the plans for that became Digital Computer to Ken Olson. He had the two filing cabinets he got from these computer scientists at MIT in payment for other work he did for CIA-related digital computer operations that were happening out of MIT. And anyway, he would regularly argue on the phone with then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and Curtis LeMay on why it was absolutely necessary to drop an atomic bomb on Hanoi, because we had to send, we couldn't allow just Hiroshima and Nagasaki to be one-offs. We had to prove to the communists that the capitalists were so out of control that they would stop at nothing, including one more nuclear bomb. So, and you may know more recently, because RFK Jr. has been running for president and speaking on a lot of podcasts, he explains repeatedly the story of Curtis LeMay trying to argue with his RFK Jr.'s uncle, JFK, to do a false flag in Miami where they'd blow up a mall and blame it on Cubans, and then that would give the U.S. the reason to invade Cuba. And of course, and that's when Khrushchev put in nuclear weapons and so on, and the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. And so that's the same Curtis LeMay who, oddly enough, did not drop an atomic bomb on Hanoi, potentially because they knew there'd be retaliation by Russia or Soviet Union at that time. But still was willing to do other false flags. So, I knew about false flags and how the society worked in reality from, my earliest days. He died. I spent the summer between eighth grade and ninth grade living with him. But I spent a lot of time with him. And he was a really interesting guy and very great, nice as a, very gentle, wonderful person as a grandfather. But not shy to explain how, what my future would be that he had hoped, but I definitely went a different direction. So I base a lot of my being an anarchist on my education with him, because I knew that basically you create whatever your reality yourself, because all this other stuff is an illusion, like these elections, who cares if Trump is president or Biden's president? They're actually working for other people, and they're making decisions on the behalf of those other people, not because we voted the lesser of two evils into power. And you can see that even here in Santa Cruz, California. There's not a single person that anybody liked who the most horrific people won all the elected offices in Santa Cruz in March 4th. And the worst policies were elected. And the people here hate all those people. So it's clear no one, they were just basically the surveillance company that controls our community, Google, just chose who needed to be in power, gave them money, put them in power. And now they're in power. And now they make all the horrible rules and laws that the last batch of those people were doing that were also put into power by the same people. so even from a municipal point of view, it a lot of times, if your town isn't important to the surveillance community, then you could potentially get a real election and with real votes, with real candidates who come to power in your community. But otherwise, if your town is San Francisco, LA, Santa Cruz, Boston, New York City, Miami, something like that, there's no hope. They're going to be chosen by the people in power and put into power. And no matter how much money you donate to who, no matter how what you do, you have no choice. The choice has already been made by the people that matter. And I think that lesson needs to really be learned, because that's why it is wise to remove yourself from the political and economic system as much as possible and create your own systems of mutual aid, and that's really what Food Not Bombs is. That's probably our the most threatening aspect of Food Not Bombs to the state.
Hey, y'all, it's Resonance. Yeah, from the Let's Make Some Shit podcast. Here telling you guys about some of the new stuff I've got at Appalachian Apothecary. Right now I have a remineralizing tooth powder that's made with calcium carbonate and bentonite clay. I have a 4-ounce jar that I'm selling for $10 a piece. And then also I've done a couple of body butters. They're whipped tallow body butters. One's infused with arnica and the other one is a very potent pain reliever. And if you'd like more info on that, you can find me at radical_resonance on Telegram or at Mother of Chaos, XAOS on Twitter. I'd be happy to make tinctures for you regarding like any medical condition that you have. So please reach out to me and let's see if we can get you some herbal remedies.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, yourself and Food Not Bombs is actually a threat from the perspective of, you know, the national security state, the state overall, and you know, the FBI. I don't think you're terrorists for feeding people, but, you know, it definitely shows an example through, you know, what you can do through direct action outside of, you know, state power and, you know, state services. And that to me is the threat to the greater state. Now, I might have just answered my own question, but what is the relationship to you between food and war, and especially in our current geopolitical climate?
So yeah, well, first I will tell the story of where the name came from, which is, so basically I was a produce worker while I was studying painting and sculpture at Boston University. And I would take the produce and day-old bread and stuff that I couldn't sell from Bread and Circus, which was the natural food store I was working at. And I would take it to the housing projects on Portland Avenue in Cambridge. And one day the mothers, who were the people that I was giving the food to, were telling me about this new building that had just been completed across the street. But most of the land across from this housing project was vacant lots, but there was this brand new glass building with a 3-story concrete parking garage outside of it. And they told me that that's where they designed nuclear weapons. And I thought, wow, you guys tell me stories about how your electricity doesn't work. You can't get somebody to fix the plumbing for like a month. You want all this free wilted produce and stuff that I'm bringing you, you know, it was all organic, which for people living in projects was totally unique at that time. And so anyway, that's where I gave him the name Food Not Bombs. I said, man, you know, people here desperate for food in 1980, while they're designing the guidance system, which now is GPS, basically, for intercontinental nuclear missiles across the street at the Draper Laboratories. And now Tech Square, which is a hugely CIA intelligence. That whole giant vacant lot now has got like 20, you know, 20-story, 30-story buildings, and they're doing the most evil stuff on Earth. But anyway, so that's where the name came from. And then the other thing is really the first things that really, if you don't even have shelter, inadequate clothing, but you do have water and you have food, you can live. So our philosophy was that we wanted to set up decentralized, non-hierarchical organizations that provided for the basic necessities and had that focus, because we don't need money for bombs and for the military and for, you know, all the kind of corporate capture that one sees, that, you know, because bombs can really be symbolic of all of corporate power, because they need bombs to maintain it, for sure. And that food being the most basic thing. So we actually had a little bit of discussion at the beginning whether to call it Bread Not Bombs or Food Not Bombs. And we decided to call it Food Not Bombs, one, because bread in those days was also like money, you know, it was a synonymous with the word money. And so we realized people would just make fun of us if we're like, oh, they just want money, not bombs or whatever. I don't know. So that was one of our issues that we called ourselves. And we had been for a couple of months called the Food for Free Committee. Even a few months before that, we were called the Food and Drug Administration. But we thought that would bust our LSD mushroom pot business. So we abandoned that. So and then I put a slogan on a flyer, which is actually in the front of the Hungry for Peace, where it says Food Not Bombs in quotes, we never sell out. And we were still the Food for Free Committee on that flyer. And then we decided to. Wouldn't it be great if we showed up at the natural food store to get the food they're throwing out? And then we said, hey, we're Food Not Bombs, and try to get this mantra into popular culture where people go, yeah, we should be focusing on food and not on bombs. And then, you know, at the same time that we started Food Not Bombs, Mira Brown and some other Carl, wow, I forget Carl's last name. Carl was working at the Bike Collective, as Cambridge Bike Collective, as was Miriam. And there was an embargo against Nicaragua for oil, so they were starting to depend on bicycles. And so it was illegal to send bike parts and stuff to Nicaragua, but they did it anyway as a civil disobedience, a direct action. And so they started a thing called Bikes Not Bombs, which then ended up ended up being a hierarchical organization in the end, in JP, Jamaica Plain, you know, had a staff and so on. So it went a different direction in that regard, but it was bringing bikes to Nicaragua. And then
let me jump in real quick. You just reminded me of something, and maybe you are familiar with this because nobody else I've ever talked to has heard of this. But when I was a young kid, my parents and all their friends, they were anti-war activists, and they did a thing very often they called a pencil wrap, which meant they wrapped up like pencils and notebooks and all of this kind of and other, you know, goods. This was during the war in Nicaragua, and they would send them to Nicaragua. Was that a widespread thing? Have you ever heard of that, or was that just something my parents and their friends were into? Because I can remember going when I was a lad, and it seemed like mostly just an excuse for them all to get together and smoke pot, but they were sending all sorts of goods to Nicaragua. Was that a widespread thing at the time?
Well, amongst the left it certainly was. So my then at another couple years after I left it, 195 Harvard Street, the original building where the first collective was, when that collective broke up, I moved into another place called 41 Gardner Street over in Boston, Alston. And one of my roommates there was Jonathan Rosenblatt, and he started a thing called Equal Exchange because he was influenced by us and what the Bikes Not Bombs was doing. And his purpose was to break the embargo by importing coffee from Nicaragua and selling it in natural food stores in the United States. So that's where the origin of Equal Exchange came from. So their Equal Exchange coffee, which I think you can still buy probably in every natural food store in America. And so I remember that those early meetings in the living room with Jonathan, and he was a person that had a bit of resources, and he was very compassionate about what was going on in Nicaragua. Also, I could point out, so it is kind of, it was a thing at the time. And then amongst the people that were aware that of the Contra war and the blockade and the violations of the Boland Amendment, which Bill Clinton was involved in, you know, there's a very famous situation where a guy named Hassan Fuss, who was working in the Oliver North Singlob, you know, C-Cord network, were flying down guns to Central America to illegally to arm the Contras. And then the Contras were the CIA organized terrorist group. And Mira Brown went down there with Benjamin Linder. Mira had gone to Evergreen to learn small scale hydro powered electricity production. That's where she met Benjamin Linder. I'd known him from when I was in Portland. He was a clown in the days I knew him. And we were working to shut down Trojan Nuclear Power Station there. But a few years later, probably almost like 8 or 9 years later, she meets up with Benjamin, and they go to Nicaragua, and the Contras actually kill the people in the little workspace that she was, where they're doing this hydroelectric generating project. But Mira was away that day to a clinic and did not get killed, but Benjamin did. And that's a very famous U.S. citizen being killed by U.S. Backed Contras in Nicaragua. A lot of people know of Benjamin Linder from that. And, you know, so that was Mira Brown, of one of the eight founders of Who Not Bombs. And anyway, so... yeah, I think a lot of people, but the war in El Salvador was just like the U.S. war against Russia that's been going on now for over 10 years, the armed conflict against Russia. Most Americans didn't really know what that was about. It wasn't hardly in the media. The FBI was really concerned about it, definitely. I have another friend, Carl Chasky, who, unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but he was a computer expert, and he did the encryption, made it so that the FBI could not get into the Committee on Solidarity with the People of El Salvador computers during that time. And there was a break-in in Boston by the FBI to steal all the, you know, the mailing lists and everything of the people in the Pledge Resistance and in the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, who are organizing against the Contra War and the war in El Salvador. And the FBI, and Carl's, one of his proudest things is the FOIA document showing that they were so frustrated. They said no one in the FBI could break into the C-Space computers because of Carl Chasky was made it impossible. And you could also thank Carl for being able to, pay securely online, because he was in the team that of anarchists that invented what we now think of as PayPal, and which is run by the CIA. So there you go again. And Peter Thiel and Joe Lansdale and the other CIA data collecting experts, basically took that software. Indie media. You know, that started with Who Not Bombs. Carl was involved in that, a bunch of other people. In the lead up to the 1995 Who Not Bombs World Gathering in San Francisco, where over 1,000 people went through the Media Convergence Center, and we had 10 days of amazing actions, and one of them of which was the founding of Indie Media. And then some Who Not Bombs and other anarchists in Melbourne, Australia, took that idea, because it started to become indie media centers all around the world, and because it was taken away from San Francisco from that gathering, and they figured out how to upload sound and photo and videos to the web, where the file transfer program was just integrated into the indie media website, so any person could just, post their images and video and recordings onto the web. And that, by the time of the Battle of Seattle against the World Trade Organization in November of 99, that system was up and running worldwide. And that is one of the reasons a lot of people think of that as the first large, modern protest, was the blockade of the World Trade Organization summit in Seattle. I spent I started in 1996 organizing for whatever protests would happen against the World Trade Organization at any summit in North America. And then, by having this indie media, that meant the mainstream media, the corporate media, couldn't suppress the protest. And so it became widespread. Whereas, a lot of people are completely unaware that the Rodney King uprising happened all over America. Most people think of it as L.A., but that's because we didn't have a global media, project happening at that time. Or like that, a million people came to protest in San Francisco in the first day of Desert Storm under George Bush Sr. and his 45-day bombing of Iraq. So, you know, that the Indian media really broke things wide open. The other, to be quite fair, though, there were international media, of corporate media, at Seattle because it was a World Trade Organization. So, and the protest was quite dramatic and colorful, and something that, you know, European media and you know, Asian media and so on might want to cover. So that did, you know, the fact that we shut down the World Trade Organization first summit did make world news, but a lot of it was because of they had to compete with indie media's ability to get the word out. And so that I think is an interesting aspect of Food on Bombs. Also, so we were creating our own media. We also started these pirate radio stations. We had about 400 low watt neighborhood FM radio stations in North America, mostly in the US, but some in Canada, some in Mexico. I was very connected to San Francisco Liberation Radio and had my own afternoon show once a week there. In fact, when the Zapatistas, so I was connected to the Zapatistas through John Ross before the uprising, official uprising, against NAFTA on January 1st of 94. So we had we read their communique in English from the pirate radio station on top of Twin Peaks in San Francisco. And then a couple of days later, I had a sign in front of City Hall that said, Viva Zapatista, no NAFTA. I was wearing a chef's hat and chef's coat. And it was at that, because of that, that's when I got framed on my first strike, assault, battery, strong arm robbery, when the mayor's film commissioner attacked me in a phone booth on that day. And that law was 4 days old at that point. So anyway, so there was our media. Then the other thing we had in 92, because the savings and loan crisis, which was like the housing foreclosure crisis of 2007, 2008, it was just another version of it. And the savings and loan crisis was actually a directly part of Iran-Contra, what people call Iran-Contra, where Oliver North, he's probably the most famous person in this thing, were involved in the Contra War. And that's where Clinton, where Hassan Fuss and all the stuff was leaving out of Arkansas. And Clinton was running guns and cocaine, you know, through the Contra War. And the way one of the things they had to get rid of was a lot of money. So one of the things they did was they were able to manipulate laws so that the people running this operation could start their own savings and loans and be, you know, get rid of, you know, have a way of laundering money. And that's largely, for instance, how Phoenix, Arizona got to be so huge, because they had to dump money somewhere. So they built like roads everywhere and fire hydrants and stuff like that. And with the future that all those thousands of acres of beautiful saguaro that were cut down would then be a massive, sprawling, ugly city, and it became that. That was like Charles Keating, Lloyd Benson, the Democrat from Texas. John McCain was their front man for this thing. So that whole operation was the same as why they were holding the hostages intentionally, the 52 CIA spies in the embassy in Iran. And, you know, so there's all these things, covert operations were all intertwined. So with the savings and loan scandal, there's all these, you know, their idea was, we'll just get all this property and we'll keep the money and we'll walk on the mortgages and then leave all these abandoned properties all over America, which they did. So we had broke into, when we find a savings and loan abandoned property in San Francisco, we put our own locks on it. And then we called our action Homes Not Jails. And so then during the Food Not Bombs meal, the dinner meal, because we had both a lunch and a dinner through that period of time, 7 days a week in San Francisco, we would find the most, the people that looked to need to get off the streets the most, and talk to them and invite them to meet us at 9 o'clock at a property that we had already liberated and already had started to fix up and repair. And then they would come, and at 9, we'd open the door because we had the lock, move the people into the house. We would deliver food for a while so they could stay there without having to, you know, to so it could sort of defend the property, mainly from other squatters. And then we would, you know, and then we give them a lease and so on like that, help them turn on the electricity and the water. And we had, according to the book, No Trespassing, not only keys to 400 houses, which were all hanging on a wall at the San Francisco Tenants Union and the Mission, but also we had people living in 100 of those houses at any given time. So that was another, you know, decentralized, non-hierarchical, anarchist housing program that we had that was also protest related. And then, you know, and then we had Food Not Lawns sprung up. That becomes another, you know, decentralized, non-hierarchical, local food growing program. So we got the media with the pirate radio, with indie media, Homes Not Jails taking over houses, Food Not Bombs feeding people, the really, really free markets, which that was started by Food Not Bombs in New Zealand as a, when a free market conference moved in. It was coming to the university across the street from where they serve food. And they said, well, the screw that, we'll have a really, really free market. And then, you know, New Zealand Food Not Bombs activists and Australian Food Not Bombs activists started spreading through South Asia, and it picked up in places like Kuala Lumpur, and eventually became a thing in the U.S. at the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas protest in Miami, I think in 2002, 2003. That's where the informant Anna started hooking up with Food Not Bombs, and who then eventually was involved in a frame-up of Eric McDavid and Zachary and Wren as domestic terrorists. And poor David ended up getting sentenced to 19 years, but he was able to be freed in 9 years when it was finally proven that the entire terrorist conspiracy was invented by the FBI, and that Anna was not Anna, and that she was an informant. And I always thought, because I ran into her a few times, that there was something up about her. But, you know, I was many years older than them, and I thought it was weird that Eric was kind of had the hots for her, and because he seemed like such a cool, gentle person and very smart and very soft-spoken. I have a section in Hungry for Peace, and I think maybe even in Eric's cookbook, on how to avoid being framed and convicted of terrorism, partially based on his experience, which is, he didn't take it seriously when she was joking about bombing dams and robbing banks and stuff like that. He just thought that was complete nonsense. So he never spoke out about it. And so the audio tapes of those conversations, they don't have him responding. And therefore, they were able to use the them to as proof that he was involved in the conspiracy that he had no idea he was involved in. And so that happened to a number of Food Not Bombs people over the years. And thankfully, since Eric's case, and maybe the last such case was the Cleveland Five, where three Food Not Bombs kids got convicted and sentenced to 10 years for being, you know, maneuvered into a May Day bombing of a bridge in Cleveland, even though, and it turned out it was all FBI. The entire thing was invented by the FBI. And the
there's cases like that just over and over and over again with the FBI just framing up dissidents over and over and over again.
Such cases.
Oh yeah. Maybe 15, 20 minutes left. Let's talk about how the state is coming after Food Not Bombs and other related things currently, right now, we were talking about before we started recording.
Yeah. So right now, the big news of this week is Peterborough, Ontario Food Not Bombs, after having served for 19 years in front of City Hall across the street in a park, was told they were no longer allowed to serve food there and they would have to get a permit and so on. So they've been resisting that and continuing to go out and serve food. And I think Peterborough city government will eventually back off. But it is getting some big news in Canada. So that's like this week's repression against Food Not Bombs. Now, the Houston Food Not Bombs, which has been an ongoing struggle for a while, they received nearly 100 tickets worth $2,000 each ticket for serving food in front of the library where they have been for 14 years, I believe. Eventually, it seems like they're no longer getting tickets. And one of the problems for the city of Houston, so their idea, and this is classic, was they wanted Houston Food Not Bombs, like they did with San Francisco in the early days, to move to this underpass by a freeway next to a police precinct, out of the way in a construction yard. And they refused to do that because they're part of what our goal is, to end war. So anyway, so when they had the last series of jury trials, or trying to, they couldn't get a jury because no one thought it was reasonable to fine people $500 for feeding the hungry in front of a library. So they had to abandon their legal case. Now, that legal case could potentially come back, but they have stopped ticketing. The other place is that there's an ongoing pressure to try to shut down Memphis, Tennessee Food Not Bombs, but those people have been resisting, and the city has not really come down hard on them. I think, they might have Googled Food Not Bombs and found out that after 1,000 arrests in San Francisco and literally millions of dollars, they never stopped the group, and it just continues to this day to share free food. Or Tampa Food Not Bombs, same thing. Fort Lauderdale won a federal appeal and for the right to serve food as a First Amendment activity, and the ruling there was really positive, and maybe they're going to mellow out there. And then the other place is West Palm Beach has been trying to get Food Not Bombs there to hide, and that group has been refusing, and it seems like they may give up on harassing them. So by just resisting and not cooperating and sticking by our principles, it seems like we've been able to push back on the most recent repression there. Now, on the homeless issue, which this is something that is, I think, the very, very disturbing. And one of the disturbing aspects of it is how few people are talking about it. And that is that the homeless population, according to HUD's point in time count, increased by 11% between 2022 and the end of 2023. So now, if you do Food Not Bombs anywhere, you can see that the numbers are growing and growing like they are here. And particularly when you know the homeless population because you've been feeding them for years, and you start seeing lots of new people, it's a mind blower. So I believe that right now 78% of America is living paycheck to paycheck. And I'm getting between 10 to 20 phone calls a day from seniors who are being referred to me through the Aetna United Health and so on, who think that the Food Not Bombs Hunger Hotline is Meals on Wheels. And the stories I hear are unbelievable. And people are angry. They are so angry. I had a woman called me from North Carolina the other day who was like, Southern Georgia. I worked my whole life. And I got $150 in food stamps a month and hardly any Social Security. And here I am starving and so on. And why are we sending all this money? Many will speak of why are we sending all this money to Ukraine? I think that's a lot because a lot of people are watching Fox TV. But I agree with them. And people are real mad and they're desperate and they just feel abandoned. And I'm hearing this story like all day long. And then the solutions are, and then this also makes me think of why the poverty pimp industry hates Food Not Bombs and why they align with these campaigns to stop us like they did in San Francisco or like they did in Houston or like they did in everywhere where the government's trying to stop us. We don't get their money. We don't have paid staff. We do we can't be controlled. And the city governments have food programs turn off the food at will for manipulate the local population. However, that's like really common. So that's another threat to the state. But so anyway, right now there's been a campaign that was started in 2016 by a guy by the name of Joe Lonsdale. And he's, well, he, is connected to the CIA. He co-founded with Peter Thiel, who is known for PayPal, the Palantir, which is a digital surveillance company that was funded originally by the CIA. So he's co-founder of an organization started whose seed money was the CIA's money, and whose job is to provide contractor services to all 17 spy agencies in the U.S. plus Interpol and Mossad and so on. And so that he started the Palantir, I think, in 2004 or 5, and then he started the Cicero Institute in 2016. And one of its principal goals is to make it a crime to be homeless in the United States. And so he's been pushing these laws, and I think he's got like 8 states already have adopted the laws. And he's pushing it currently. So he's got Arizona, Georgia, Kentucky, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. But he's also pushing it in California. In California, it's called Senate Bill 1011. And what it would make it illegal to be within 500 feet of almost every place in most urban areas. So you could be given a ticket or you could be given a misdemeanor citation. And it goes hand in hand with this other philosophy that he's pushing called obligation to accept shelter. So in Senate Bill 1011, they can let you sleep on the street if they don't have adequate housing, shelter. And it was written in such a way because there's a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case called Martin versus Boise, which was meaning that they could just tell you to move and they could confiscate all your belongings, but they couldn't really criminalize you just for being outside. They'd have to make up some other crime, which they would often do. So in this case, they decide they would make it an over crime in the entire state of California to sleep in all kinds of places, like 500 feet from open space, schools, government buildings, things of that nature. And so he's pushing that across the country. The most egregious one is Kentucky, where they are not only making it illegal to be homeless, to have homeless encampments or to sleep in doorways and so on, but that the public can use their state stand your ground law to use guns on homeless people if you feel you have to. So that is happening. Then in California, there's also a proposition that just passed called Proposition 1, which was touted. They were using the state of California, and it was like a Governor Gavin Newsom campaign, basically, where it was like they had help, not tents, or something. And they're claiming that they're going to help you by putting you in a mental hospital and putting you on psychiatric drugs. And that's a bond measure that raised $6 billion to build mental hospitals to incarcerate the homeless. And they already have a statewide thing called the CARES Court, where you go, and I have a couple of friends have already had this happen, not even with the CARES Court. They just captured homeless people, diagnosed them with mental health issues that they did not have. I mean, they had issues, but not the ones that they were diagnosed with. They just were, unusual people, hippies, basically. You can diagnose them as hippies, and then ruined their lives. They became wards of the state. Their money's controlled by a public guardian, and the courts tell them where to go, what to do. So put them in mental hospitals until they lost all their property, and then and forced them into being drugged. And in one case, the person went cold turkey on the psychiatric drugs, and died of a heart attack shortly afterwards, within a week or two. And the other is just lost like 100 pounds in 6 months and is now kind of bedridden in a facility. But he did like weeks and weeks in mental hospitals, drugged against his will, and lost everything he owned. And so this, now they're going to make state policy here.
What do you think is behind this push, and what does it have to do with the CIA And, you know, does this have anything to do with the potential for another world war?
You know, I think that that's why we should be so concerned, because this is the...
Hey, y'all, I got something cool to tell you about. So, you know how I'm doing a big initiative to try to get more people to Gorilla Garden? Well, Daggerist over at agoristacres.com, he's kind of teaming up with me a little bit here to help support this cause. So if you use the code Agora10 over at agoristacres.com, you'll get 10% off for any reason you're buying seeds, whether that be Gorilla Gardening or your own garden, anything like that. But if you contact Daggerist or myself and you tell them that I sent you to get seeds for Gorilla Gardening, he might be able to swing an additional hookup. It might be just whatever he's got, you know, a surplus of or that kind of thing, whatever he can do. So he's down for the cause here and really wants to help see this come to fruition. So I am Sec Magora, at Sec Magora on all the social media. You can contact Daggerist directly on his website, agoristacres.com again. And the code is Agora10 to just get 10% off straight up. And tell him I sent you for Gorilla Gardening, and he'll try to hook you up however he can. And this is what we got to do. We got to support people that support us that want to see more of this in the world. So again, it's agoristacres.com. Check it out, and get out there and cause a ruckus and get some Gorilla Gardening done. All right, y'all, peace.
We are going into World War III. I mean, maybe during this podcast of, you know, hopefully no tactical nukes will be used this week, but it is getting really heavy. You know, there's like another 24 heavy bombers are currently, as we speak, bombing Ukraine from air bases out of Russia. And Ukraine is bombing Crimea but like crazy. And you've got like all kinds of U.S. and European politicians talking about trying to overthrow Putin, and they have been now for several years. And, you know, and the New York Times even came out, the CIA intentionally leaked a story about themselves to the New York Times, how they were involved in the original coup, or the second coup, the one in Maidan coup in 2014, and that they've been running that war, according to them in this New York Times article, for the entire 10 years. And so, and of course, the CIA actually got to start in Ukraine right after World War II, when they first started, and they've been working, collaborating with Nazis since that time in Ukraine, which is why, you know, you can get like organs from Ukraine, you can get brides from Ukraine, you can get orphaned kids from Ukraine. You know, all that has been happening for the entire time, largely because there's such a huge influence by the CIA on the Ukrainian society. But and why there's such a large Nazi movement there, because you know, they've been cultivated since World War II by, you know, not only by their own people that are Nazis, but by collaboration with the CIA. So anyway, so this world war is about to happen, and we saw in World War II, one of the things that did happen was the Germans interned all the homeless at the beginning of the war, and many of them had a choice whether to just work in the factories and on the war effort in these concentration camps like Dachau, or they could go to the Eastern Front or the Western Front. And I think that that's part of what's going on here. We also do, at the same exact time they were rounding up homeless people in Germany, they had Japanese internment camps over here in the United States. So we're not, you know, it'll be more like I believe in the U.S., it'll be more the Japanese internment camps, where it's not where you're going to be like. But then what will happen is the able-bodied homeless people that are going to get sick of being in these internment camps will volunteer, you know, to join the military, because then they'll get to, you know, they'll be out of the internment camp and they will get some income and they will be probably promised college education like they're doing now. So I think that's a lot of what's going on. I think there's also an aspect to the immigration crisis, which is where they're planning to, the CIA is assuming that there'll be people that want to get the U.S. citizenship, and they'll promise them that. And they did this in the Iraq War as well, in the Afghan War, same thing. And then you will go off to fight, and if you survive the war, then you'll be made a U.S. citizen. Although it's wink, wink, nod, nod, they actually typically don't do what they promise, you know. But anyway, so I think that's part of the reason. I think the other big reason is that, you know, when you have, I'm sure the CIA is aware that the homeless population in the United States is going to balloon, particularly if this is a world war, because then you're going to have even more problems with access to oil and energy, and therefore the price of everything will go way up. Particularly if there's a conflict in the Persian Gulf, which looks like that's definitely something people are trying to get started. And you already have the blockade of some oil shipments through the Indian Ocean and the Suez Canal. So it's kind of surprising oil prices aren't already going higher than they have been. But gold prices are skyrocketing by comparison. And that's typically a sign of people who are aware of world wars coming in the future start to, you know, find something that they can, that will survive the war financially for them. You can also see the wealthiest people in the world are dumping their stock right now. So there's that. So I think what's going to happen is that they know that millions of Americans will be homeless in the near future, and they've got to have a plan for that, because their plan definitely is not, and could have been for the entire 44 years of Food on Bombs existence, to create and, you know, have wages and benefits that made it possible for and cost of rent and mortgages and so on to be something that people could afford. All of that is, of course, not possible. So I think that they never. You know, they could have ended homelessness, like they could have never had homelessness. You know, when we started, that we were protesting, saying that if Reagan and the Chicago Boy Economic School of Economics or neoliberal structural adjustments was to become a reality and abandon what little Kensington economics was happening, which was also crap. But anyway, that there would be more and more homeless people. And exactly what happened. They got rid of public housing largely and stopped funding halfway houses for mental health suffering people. And just, the whole thing, you know, we kept seeing increased number of homeless. And so I think that's their concern. We're about to go into have literally millions and millions of people living outside in the streets, possibly even before if there is even an election before the November. So they need a way to handle that. And this is why their strategy is to handle it this way. And
if they've got plans like that, sorry to cut you off, that means that we need plans of our own. And the time was yesterday, but now is the time that we should be building systems that exist outside of the state control. I mean, everybody here, I assume, would agree. And you're an excellent example of that. And I hope more people look to you, because, man, you've had a wild ride. You've done it. You've done it all, and successfully as well. And I hope more people could do what they can in their local communities for themselves and for the people around them to try to create some sort of network and safety nets outside of the state. Because if you're correct, I think it's becoming more and more, a dire necessity for these things to be in place. hopefully before it actually happens. So,
yeah, well, I think people do need to rush and get the, and thankfully there's like every major city in the U.S. and in Canada has a Food Not Bombs. So that, so one of the things that's so, it's a simple way to practice anarchism. And it's also a good way to branch out. Because see, you know, I just did a lecture on, you know, a lot of people in prepping, you know, they, you know, their idea is you get a gun, you have a bunch of gold, you hold up in your house, whatever, and shoot the hordes of psychos coming to rob you. But the reality is the real solution is to have community. Because if you all band together, so I know just from doing Food Not Bombs Forever, when the homeless community in my town, and this is everywhere, are the people that did build your town. You know, they're the electricians, they're the plumbers, they're the farmers, they're the, you know, the people that paved the highways, they're the people that prepared the meals. So you have all those skills that will, I mean, we even have people living in Teslas eating at Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz. So because the high-tech industry collapsed, you know, and Google's laying off I guess 25,000 people have laid off in the last few months in Google, and we're the headquarters of Google, basically. So, but we have that talent out there. So it's a matter of building community and working together and encouraging the best of one another and not, and, you know, not, you know, so that, and so we do have that nucleus right now, but that, so that it's working together to support one another in chaos like this. And one of the lessons I learned, I know we have to stop soon, but when I started Food Not Bombs, there was this, Al Vellucci was the mayor of Cambridge, Massachusetts. He loved Food Not Bombs. And the city council totally loved us. One of, Carol Hill, city councilor there, was in the Black Panthers and in the Black Panther breakfast program and so on. And so he would often speak about that spirit of the Great Depression and how the government, particularly in the beginning, completely abandoned everybody. And it was like this beautiful experience of everyone coming together once there was no money to be sought for. And he, and I remember him speaking about how we were that example, but that's 1980. He's talking, speaking that way. And here we are. So yeah, just collective working together as equals in your community. And using the resources of the human knowledge that we have is already in the homeless population and the people about to become homeless. You know, that's where our strength is. And just be community-based, locally-based, where you can ride your bike with the message to the person, people you need, or you can hold the sign on the street corner of the news of the day, because if there's no electricity, which is in any ongoing way, that's a definite possibility. You know, they'll, you know, hopefully, I mean, we're actually friendly with the local on the ground police people, even though, and even the chief of police in this town, even though they are ordered to do ugly things to us. But we know when the push comes to shove in every revolution, your politeness, their families are becoming homeless too, right? The cops' families are moving to the streets. So they might not like us as people right now, but there's going to be a time when they're going to have to eat with us. We know that because like in October 17th, 1989, there was a huge earthquake in San Francisco. And they had been arresting us the day before for feeding the hungry on the 16th of October. And then on the 17th of October, the police lined up with everybody else to get dinner, and they ate with us for three more days until the Red Cross finally arrived to the city. And because there was no other place to get food than from us. So, so you know, we have lessons from being a lifelong anarchist, being able to flow with the reality of current events as they really are on the streets with no attachment to some kind of institutions. And therefore, really, the future will be anarchist collectives and people in thinking in a outside of the box, non-hierarchical way, working cooperatively together will be our not only our survival, but it will also be this flourishing possibilities. You know, I was very influenced by Thoreau. He was the first anarchist, Henry David Thoreau, when Big I was fan. In the fifth grade. Yeah. And I loved the, and I, you know, my family was from, my mom's side of the family was from around there, Concord. And I just thought the Transcendentalist movement and what was going on in Concord. So I've always been striving to create a my own Concord. And I think that the World War III, if it doesn't go nuclear to the extent where it physically damages us in North America, sadly, somewhat unlikely, but maybe it will be minor. You know, it'll be this new awakening. I think you can see that with the Gaza genocide, there is definitely a new awakening amongst a lot of people. That was a mask off how power works event. Is an event of that nature to see such brutality go unchallenged by other governments in any real way. Oddly enough, in the ugliness of that is providing us with an odd possibility of hope of many, many more millions of people realizing they can find no hope in electropolitics. They can't find any hope in following the directions of those in power, of cooperating with the political and economic system that is failing literally billions and billions of people worldwide, and who is intent on creating a global dystopian digital prison, centralized prison of all of us. So it's a yin yang again, where we are the hope, we are decentralized, we're like the forest, we are many people from many, many, you know, that decentralization energy of nature is really our future. If we're going to have a future, whereas this monocrop centralized top-down authoritarian world government system that is jockeying for total control is likely to fail, because it is not not like the forests and the ocean, you know, and the land. It is devoid of it. It's nothing but a technocratic, authoritarian, lost, soulless world that they're trying to create. And our many spiritual backgrounds and so on, and the diversity of the actual people that are making the world happen in real life, the workers, the deplorables, the essential workers, you know, there's a great deal of hope in that. And that's what that personal contact every day or every week at a Funabom's meal or other mutual aid projects is so fundamental. And to have 44 years of practicing, I think does, you know, we've been looking at the long game because, you know, and thankfully we are maybe at that point where it's like the 100th monkey idea that we used to talk about in the anti-nuclear movement in the 80s, where for some reason monkeys started washing their food in a stream, and all monkeys all over the world started doing that because of some kind of consciousness that protected them from whatever that they were subconsciously perceiving was important to do. That story may be hopefully becoming a reality under the circumstances that we face now. So,
well, very, very well said. I could not have said that better. And we got to wrap it up here.
Okay, but, cool. Beautiful.
It's about dinner time for me, but thank you again for coming on, and thank you for all that you do. Penguin, do you have anything to add real quick?
No, that was a great, that was some wild stories. So I definitely had no idea, even with your previous appearances, that you have just probably tons of stuff that you haven't even touched on yet, but you've definitely lived an amazing life. You've spawned, that you haven't done directly, but this all the stuff that you spawned and have kept tabs on and everything, and the people that you inspired. So yeah, thank you for coming on and telling us about all that.
Yeah, thank you so much. So.
Is there anything you want to plug real quick before you leave? Or,
well, the main things are, you know, it's for people to go to foodnotbombs.net and either start So if you go to the tab that is volunteer, you can see all the types of potential tasks that local Food Not Bombs have. There's a map on foodnotbombs.net under locations where you can find your local chapter. And then the, or you could go to the other tab on volunteer on how to start a Food Not Bombs and start a Food Not Bombs. And I have to say almost every day, there's two or three individuals contact me to either restart a dormant chapter or start a new chapter. And so I think that's a really, you know, it's a great way to get started on resisting what is happening and preparing to create this more utopian way of living in the shadows of a collapsed empire. So that's, I encourage people to go to that, foodnotbombs.net, and then my blog is anarchistcook.blog. And hopefully this book will be somebody with some, you know, some, you know, money that can promote the book a bit without, you know, cannibalizing the book from me or something. That's definitely a thing I'm working on. It will come out, you know, that's right now it's called Soup Street. And that shares a bunch of these kind of stories, but not any of the ones that you just heard.
Well, we look forward to that. And again, thanks for coming on and for all you do, man. You're an inspiration. And take care of yourself. And everybody listening, be excellent to each other.
Yes, fantastic. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Peace.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.